Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry. Once again, this has been recorded on December 5th of 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to welcome back to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and that's the focal point of this broadcast. Robert, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, we've been talking about the October surprise, the gambit through which the Reagan-Bush campaign sabotage the peace negotiations to release the U.S. hostages that had been taken from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in November of 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. This also provided a major propaganda boost for the incoming Reagan administration, which was able to spin this as a result of the Iranians' fear of the incoming tough cowboy Ronald Reagan. One of the things you go into in Secrecy and Privilege is how the people that were, quote, investigating, unquote, and please note the quotes, the October surprise actually had profound conflicts of interest, which contributed in a major way to the cover-up, effectively, of this. I wonder if you detail that for us.
Well, sure. To understand what happened with the October surprise investigation that went back to the 1980-ish time frame, one has to understand what happened to the Iran-Contra investigation. The Iran-Contra scandal finally breaks out in the fall of 1986, and we find out at that point that there have been secret operations, some of which few of us in the press corps, I was at AP at the time, doing a lot of the work on especially the Contra side of the operation. But we find out in the fall of 86 that there were these secret dealings that had been going on involving George Bush, the vice president, Ronald Reagan, William Casey, the CIA director, some of the same characters who we'll go back to and see in the 1980 issue, but they are playing key roles as well in the Iran-Contra affair as it breaks apart in the fall of 86. Very soon after that, however, because of the tone, the mood of Washington, which was, first of all, that Reagan had won a big re-election in 84, there was a strong sentiment not to have another Watergate. And it wasn't just from the Republicans, who had been really working hard in terms of building their own institutions, their own news organizations, to try to protect any future Republican president from having another Watergate. But there was also hesitancy among Democrats to have another Watergate, that is, have a constitutional crisis that might force the impeachment or the forced resignation of a second Republican president. The press corps felt, surprisingly, maybe to some, much the same way. In the Washington Post company, which I went to work for at Newsweek, there was a strong sense that we don't want to go through that again. It was not as, sometimes people might think that it's a great thrill to be involved in those kinds of scandal stories, but there's an awful lot of pain that goes into them, and Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, was not eager to go through it again. She'd gotten to be very good friends with the Reagans. She really didn't want to see this, and that was a feeling that was fairly broadly felt across Washington. So there was the idea that in dealing with the Iran-Contra affair that it should be basically minimized, that it should not go the full way, that there should not be full exposure of the criminality of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And so that's pretty much what occurred. There was an effort to put the blame on a few fall guys, Oliver North, John Poindexter, William Casey, who had fallen ill with cancer in late 1986 and died in May of 87. So those folks were sort of set aside as the people who would take the principal blame. And the whole story would be presented as these guys had gone out of control, they'd done their own rogue operation. That wasn't true. We now know historically through the investigations that occurred subsequently that the Iran-Contra affair was handled and approved by Ronald Reagan. George Bush Sr. had been a principal operative in it, that the CIA institutionally had been deeply involved and implicated. So it wasn't the story that was being dealt us and presented to the American people in 1987 was not the truth. It was not certainly the full truth. So when we come out of that period, toward the end of it, as people start looking back at the origins of how the Republicans made contact with the Iranians, we start going back in time, and we start going back to the very beginning of the Reagan administration and finding out about secret shipments of weapons that were done in 81, and we go back to 1980 and begin to find out that there were these curious contacts and negotiations that people were alleging. And a large number of people, really up to two dozen or so, people were describing different aspects of these contacts and dealings. So we begin to see that this was not something that just sort of popped up in the middle of the 1980s. It was something that had gone back to the Reagan campaign. However, the mood in Washington was not to pursue Iran-Contra very far, and it was certainly not to pursue these earlier issues hard at all. And there were problems with the story, too. There was one fellow who came forward who began talking, who inserted disinformation, a guy named Oswald Le Winter. He had pretended to be a source for some people, and he knew some things about the 1980 activities, but he also included information that could be shown to be false. When I interviewed him later for Public Broadcasting's Frontline program, I got him to admit that he had been spreading disinformation. He said then that he had been paid by CIA officers and operatives to insert this kind of information as a way to discredit the whole story. So you had people like this who were creating problems, and then you had the conservative press corps that would pounce on those kinds of problems and make it very difficult for anyone trying to get to the truth. Combined with that, you had when there was pressure finally to get an investigation going, and it really took off or began to be looked at more seriously by 1991 and 92. You again had you had people who were put in charge of those investigations who really didn't want to get to the truth. They were more concerned about making things work. The lead Democrat was Lee Hamilton, who had been one of the people involved in the Iran-Contra investigation in the 80s and was one of the Democrats who didn't want to have it go too far. He then is made the head of the investigation of October Surprise in 91 and 92, along with Henry Hyde, who's a very aggressive Republican trying to protect then-President Bush, who was at the center of this possible new scandal. And President Bush himself makes statements almost out of the blue, coming at a couple of press conferences, denying that he's involved with the October Surprise case. So there are a lot of reasons not to pursue it politically in Washington. And then you have Lee Hamilton picking as the chief investigator a lawyer named Larry Barcella. And Barcella was had come forward and volunteered for the job, but he also was a lawyer who had worked for some of the people who would be under investigation. He had been a key lawyer for BCCI, the corrupt Middle Eastern bank. And BCCI is part of this story because it was funneling some of the money that was going to some of the key players, including this Iranian named Cyrus Hashemi, who was allegedly a double agent pretending to work for the Carter administration, but also working for the Reagan campaign. So you had a number of problems of that sort. You had Democrats who were not eager to get to the truth, and you had Republicans who were determined to protect George H.W. Bush. And you had a press corps that had lost interest in all these Iran-Contra issues years earlier and tended to laugh at this kind of story, as they had laughed at stories like the Contra drug trafficking story, which, of course, turned out to be true, but was mocked during the 1980s and was mocked when it came back in the 1990s. And even when the CIA admitted to the Contra drug trafficking stories in 1998, the major news media, which had put them down in the 80s and earlier in the 90s, essentially ignored these admissions. So you had this climate in Washington that was not aggressive in trying to get to the bottom of these kinds of complex issues. So that was why, I think, as much as anything, there was not a willingness to pursue and find out the real facts. And I think the evidence is now pretty overwhelming that there were Republican contacts with the Iranians, and that those contacts led to interference with Carter's hostage negotiations in 1980. Some of the people that have come forward, by the way, include Yasser Arafat, who acknowledged to President Carter in the 1990s during a meeting that they had in Gaza that he had been approached by the Republicans who had wanted him to act as an intermediary with the Iranians. And the PLO had said that they had, when they went to Iran, it turned out that the Iranians already had contacts with the Republicans, so the PLO intercession was not necessary, and Arafat said he didn't act on this Republican request. But it shows that there were a lot of channels that the Republicans are trying to open to deal with the Iranians directly. We also have this remarkable report that the Russian government gave to this House task force that was run by Lee Hamilton and Henry Hyde. And the Russian report, which they were asked to provide, said that according to their intelligence files, the Republicans, including Casey and Bush, had made contacts and had dealings with the Iranians in the summer and fall of 1980, and that they had struck a deal, and that the Russians also reported that their intelligence showed that Carter was doing some things which none of us had known about either, by the way, although Carter then was the president and certainly had the legal authority to do so. So what we end up with is a lot of evidence pointing to this very important moment in American history, and the American people have been essentially been denied these facts. And so I spend several chapters in Secrecy and Privilege trying to lay out the evidence in a chronological fashion, which I'd never done before. I'd sort of always dealt with it somewhat piecemeal because as we had gotten the material. But what I do in this book for the first time is sort of show how the story begins, and the powerful personalities and the vast sums of money that are at play, starting in 79, even before the hostages are taken, but after the Shah of Iran falls and the Khomeini regime takes over, and the way these relationships with powerful Republicans evolve, and the sums of money that are being moved around, often covertly through secret bank accounts, it's a remarkable tale of how power and politics really work in the United States. It's not what I think many folks in Washington want the American people to know much about.
One of the things that's on the current political stage is the revamping of the Central Intelligence Agency under Porter Goss, not only a veteran of the Caribbean covert operations of the 60s himself, but a Republican partisan. And there's been a lot of speculation that there have been, as we're speaking on December 5th of 2004, a great many resignations, perhaps forced resignations from the CIA, and there's been a lot of discussion. In fact, Porter Goss has actually been very explicit in saying that the agency should support the president and that it should be a secret agency, the thrust being that the agency is being politicized in a direction that will further reinforce the viewpoints and policies of the Bush administration. One of the things that you go into in Secrecy and Privilege is that the politicization of intelligence, and in particular the corruption of the CIA's analytical division, particularly with regard to the Soviet Union, was a long process. And one of the major elements in this was the elder George Bush's ushering in of a Team B. I wonder if you would trace for us, because we've got about 15 minutes left in the broadcast, maybe a little less, the evolution of this politicization of intelligence from the elder George Bush's term at the CIA and the ushering in of Team B through William Casey's acceleration of that same process in the 1980s, and if time permits, also getting George Tenet's accession to the CIA and his relationship with David Boren.
Well, this is all very important because what we're dealing with today is a perversion of the information upon which the U.S. government functions. And that's not just some abstract or academic concept. It has led directly to the war in Iraq and the deaths of over 1,200 American soldiers and possibly tens of thousands of Iraqis. So when information is falsified or spun or politicized, that can have real consequences and dangerous consequences. So it's important to know how we got there, and it's important to know what the CIA was about And people often misunderstand the CIA. It's really divided into two parts. There's the operational section, which includes paramilitary kinds of secret war, if you will, and spying. And then there's the analytical division, which is supposed to take the evidence that's available in a fairly academic way, objectively, and refine it and present to the policymakers in the government the most accurate, the most unvarnished facts possible so they can make the best decisions possible. But this has often been controversial because you have strong-willed presidents at times. But the CIA's analytical division, which was, of course, founded in the 40s, has always taken pride in telling presidents what they don't want to hear, whether it was Eisenhower's bomber gap that he was complaining about, which the agency said didn't exist, or Kennedy's missile gap, which the agency said didn't exist, to telling LBJ during the Vietnam War that his bombing of North Vietnam wasn't as effective as he thought it was. So there's always been this history. And we see this history going on through the 70s. And then there's a key point in the mid-1970s when the conservatives, who are then coalescing around Ronald Reagan, who begins his run for the presidency initially in 1976 when he challenges Ford, this group of conservatives, in some cases we now call them neoconservatives, begin pushing the idea that the Soviet Union is not in decline. The CIA's view at the time was that the CIA, while dangerous, had weaknesses, and that they could be dealt with, and they were desperate for negotiation over arms control and so forth. Now, this new group of conservatives did not want that analysis to prevail. They insisted that the Soviet Union was growing in power, that it had designs on world conquest, that its economy was booming, and that its military could therefore be sustained, and it was expanding at a rapid rate, and the United States needed a renewed Cold War and a major military buildup to prevent what was called then the window of vulnerability. Now, this was the conservative view. It clashed with the CIA's analytical division view. And in 1976, in the midst of this internal Republican fight between Ford being a more moderate Republican and Reagan more conservative, George Bush Sr. was told and supported the idea of letting these neoconservatives into the CIA's analytical division to present and to develop this alternative, more dramatic, more frightening view of the Soviet Union. It became known as Team B. And Team B essentially attacked the analytical division of the agency as being weak and not assessing the danger of the Soviet Union effectively. And that became more, even before Bush left in December of 76, after Carter wins, before the Ford administration ends, Bush adopts a more apocalyptic national intelligence estimate on the Soviet strength and intent. And this is what is left for the Carter administration to deal with. Now, this effort to break down the CIA analytical division is renewed in aggressively after Reagan's victory in 1980, both first with the transition period, when the analytical division is accused essentially of treason by some of the incoming Republicans, and then after Casey takes over the agency in 81, he brings in Robert Gates, who was a close supporter of George Bush, who was also implicated, by the way, in the 1980 October surprise case, and they bureaucratically break down the analytical division of the CIA, especially the Soviet division. And what they create is a renewed fear of the Soviet menace. They exaggerate the danger. They therefore justify a major military buildup. They justify a very aggressive, violent approach to rebellions in Central America, which otherwise might have been seen as civil wars. They become east-west battles. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua are seen as a beachhead for Soviet invasion of the hemisphere. So this very bleak view of is becomes the U.S. intelligence view. But there are battles within the agency of people trying to prevent these false and exaggerated analyses being presented, but they lose. They lose the battles as we go through the 80s, and many of them are driven from the CIA, and they are replaced with people who will tell the Reagan-Bush administration what it wants to hear. And in one of the ironies of this is that the CIA is blamed by the late 80s for missing the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Reagan is credited with winning the Cold War. The irony is because the CIA didn't miss the collapse of the Soviet Union as much as it was prevented from noticing and alerting the American people and the government to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was in rapid decline for a number of years, but no one at the agency could say so, because to say so would mean they'd be driven from their jobs. So we ended up with this very falsified analysis and an exaggeration of the Soviet power. In effect, Reagan had built up a straw man and then got credit when it fell down. But that was a very important part of our history today, because this myth about Reagan winning the Cold War and having defeated this huge Soviet menace and reversed it, essentially through the war in Afghanistan and the wars in Central America, has become an important element in how this Republican grouping has sustained its power and has sustained its myth with the American people. And many of these same folks, including people like Paul Wolfowitz, who was part of Team B back in 1976, have returned with the second Bush administration. Dick Cheney, who was an important figure in the Ford administration back in the 70s, became defense secretary under the first George Bush, has then, of course, become vice president under the second George Bush. So you have a number of people who learned how to play this game in the 70s and 80s, returning in the first part of this century and applying many of the same tactics of bullying the CIA's analytical division. Cheney, for instance, would go over to Langley in the months before the invasion of Iraq and essentially pressure these bureaucrats, these CIA analysts, into writing their reports on Iraq in a more alarmist way than they may have felt justified. So the patterns have continued. The way we've perverted and politicized the intelligence has continued. And the results are that the American people have been essentially and consistently misinformed about the threats around them. They've been exaggerated. The threat of the Soviet Union was exaggerated in the 70s and 80s, and the threat of Iraq was exaggerated in the last couple of years. Consequences can be quite severe when false information is acted on by the U.S. government, as we are currently seeing.
One of the things that veteran listeners will find very gratifying in your book is there's considerable discussion in there of the Bulgarian hypothesis, namely that the KGB using Bulgarian surrogates shot the Pope in May of 1981. Veteran listeners to this broadcast will remember the extremely voluminous research that we did on that, proving that was not only so much BS, but that actually there were links between the Grey Wolves, between some of the Operation Gladio and P2-related elements in Italy, and the actual assassination, as well as the subsequent disinformation effort. And again, it's a long subject. We haven't got time to go into it here in this broadcast, but veteran listeners will appreciate that. Dealing with the issue of politicized intelligence, again, one of the points you make is that George Tenet had been very cozy with David Boren, a senator from Oklahoma, am I correct?
Right. David Boren was a senator from Oklahoma and chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the 1990s. Or late 80s and early 90s.
And was less than vigorous in some of these investigations, and you imply that that actually had something to do with George Tenet's ultimate accession to being Director of Central Intelligence. I wonder, as sort of a wrap-up item for this broadcast, because we only have a few minutes left, maybe 3 minutes left, if you could summarize that for us.
Sure. There was another scandal that was developing in the early 1990s called Iraqgate, and it followed the Persian Gulf conflict. after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, what we began to learn about more was that there had been this secret policy in the 1980s of secretly arming the Iraqis. What the Reagan-Bush administration had been doing effectively was arming both the Iranians and the Iraqis. And some of the equipment used by Saddam, including some used in his chemical warfare operations in the 80s, came through these secret U.S. facilitated contacts. Some was through third countries. Now, there was an effort to investigate that in the early 1990s, led by a couple of Democrats in Congress, and it had received some press attention, not as much as it deserved, but some. There was a point when there was a good deal of, there were witnesses coming forward who had participated. The case really went to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and one of the key operatives who was in the context of Bob Gates being named by the first George Bush as being CIA director in the early 1990s. This is what became the focus of this investigation of what Gates was doing with Iraq. However, David Boren decided to sweep this under the rug and help Gates get the CIA directorship. And get the confirmation through the Senate. And the key staff person working for Boren on this project was George Tenet. And he proved himself very useful in preventing a thorough investigation of Gates' background. He prevented the serious examination or contributed to the lack of a serious examination of the Iraq Gate issue. And that earned him a lot of brownie points. So when it came to, he was appointed, of course, to be CIA director by Bill Clinton at the end of Clinton's administration, but he was kept on in the second Bush administration. And he had, in the meantime, of course, because he was known to the Bush family as someone who would play ball with them. He had proved that back in the early 90s. So you often see these personal relationships evolving in Washington around, especially around these key moments when the Bush family has been most vulnerable or most open to investigation or criticism, the people that have helped them are people they remember. And we see the way our government has been shaped in the past 20 years has often involved these personal relationships that most Americans don't know about.
And there's a tremendous amount of inertia involved in these relationships and the subsequent unfolding of governmental affairs. And you go into that at great length and in great detail in Secrecy and Privilege. Robert, we are virtually out of time. I'd like to visit with you again and talk about, among other things, the Moon Organization, something that is playing a huge role in American society but doesn't get a lot of publicity. We have been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, currently available, and something that listeners should evaluate as a holiday gift in this season of gift-giving. This concludes Side 2, For the Record, program number 489, an interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 5th of the year 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.